And good morning, everyone. I'm Mike Berry with ONC, and I would like to thank you for joining the Adopted Standards Task Force. As a reminder, your feedback is welcomed, which can be typed in the chat feature throughout the meeting, or can be made verbally during the public comment period that is scheduled at about 11:50 Eastern Time this morning. We have a number of guest speakers with us today and joining the task force to help answer questions that they may have, and I'd like to welcome them as well. I'm going to begin roll call of our task force members, so when I call your name, please indicate that you are here. And I'll start with our co-chair, Stephen Eichner.
Good morning.
Hans Butendeck is off today, but he'll be joining us in the future. Jeff Danford. Raj Gopharti. Jim Gerges. John Kilbourne.
Good morning.
Hung Lu is also absent today, but she'll be back next week. Clem McDonald.
Here.
Devin McGraw.
Here.
Elia Oliveira. Basil Pechev. Samantha Pitts.
Basil is here, sorry. Couldn't find
it. Great, thanks, Basil. Samantha Pitts.
Morning.
Alexis Snyder.
Good morning.
Bill Sutherland.
Good morning.
Ram Charan.
Good morning.
Raymond Yui.
No.
Good morning.
And Debbie Willis. All right. Thank you, everyone. Now, please join me in welcoming Steve for his opening remarks. Steve?
Thank you. And good morning, all. Thank you for joining us. Today, we're going to continue the work that we have been doing, looking at reviewing standards listed in regulation and continuing to make or develop recommendations whether those standards should be retired or maintained or, in some cases, replaced by a newer, updated standard. Today, we're going to focus mostly on public health related standards, looking at standards that are used for exchanging data between providers and public health agencies. But before we do that, we want to clean up one outstanding discussion looking at the standards hash and security. So we will jump to line 41 in the template. If ONC wants to advance us to the...
Yep, Liz will be sharing her screen.
Thank you, Liz, and it's, I believe, line 41. And last week we were discussing whether this particular hash standard had a more modern release. And thanks to Ram, we've learned from NIST that there's not a more current release of the standard. There may be another, or there is another hash standard that could apply. There would be the potential for including language that said you could use either 180 or the other standard, but there are no significant advantages in listing the other standard. It seems to make sense to have a more limited set that's in a single reference for continued use rather than pointing people to the entirety of the NIST website or the FIPA website and or FIPS website and using any potential hash mark. So I think what we probably want to do, my recommendation would be to continue to maintain. We'd love to open the floor for some conversation on that. So do any task force members
So if I understood you correctly, Stephen, you're suggesting maintaining this standard, but also allowing folks to adopt some of the recent ones?
No. Maintain the existing standard. There is not a more current standard released. There is another potential group of standards that do the same thing. It does not seem practical to say there's anything on the website. We want to point people to a more consolidated list.
Yeah, I would agree with that. And it's also, there's no indication that this standard isn't as robust as it was when it was initially adopted. So at least to my knowledge, so there isn't any reason to move.
Right.
I mean, this is Ram here. There's a FIPS 202 that is the SHA-3 standard. So I don't know whether you want to, but that's just, I guess, I don't know. It's supposed to be better than SHA-2. So. That's the one which Matt referred to. Steve, I forwarded his email to you. But it all depends on what people are using it for. But given that, I think we can just leave as is.
Okay, and do we want to include language of, ONC?
You can just put a pointer to the FIPS 202 SHA-3, but the question is whether, who's using this is the thing. Is Shaman using SHA-2 in healthcare world?
Yeah, I'm unsure how it's being used for encrypting data.
Yeah, because we need to find out if there are any vendors who are using this. Because we are not vendors.
Basile has his hand up, Stephen.
Yeah, I wanted to. I think the context is really important, because if we're talking about web services and securing web services with certificates, and we point to this, which includes SHA-1, which is considered as a weak and insecure certificate signing method. Are we doing disservice here? I mean, FIPS is, in general, FIPS standards are required for, obviously, for government compliance. But also FIPS for a long time referenced DES and triple DES as adequate encryption, when even after it was known that they are not adequate anymore. So are we, can we keep the reference and forbid SHA-1?
Yes, I don't think there was any intention of removing the standard.
Right, but can we add that this FIPS specification, which specifies SHA-1 as a valid use, needs to be restricted in regulatory language to exclude SHA-1 that is specified in this specification, but the SHA-2 and others, SHA-256, well, all the others are fine except for SHA-1. Because if we keep that for another 3 years, I don't have a good suggestion except to bring up the point that keeping SHA-1 is not a good thing.
Okay. Mike, would it be possible for next week or 2 weeks out to get a better understanding of where the regulation is applied and what systems does the regulation apply, or what usage does the regulation apply to? In other words, yes, we understand what the standard is, but in what situation is the standard being used?
And in particular, I would contrast two usages. One is for certificate signing, and the other use is for checksum against existing entities. For checksum, SHA-1 is fine. This whole thing would be fine. For certificate signing, it's not.
Okay, and is that the application of the regulation?
Right, that is the question.
So is SHA-2 the appropriate replacement?
All the others listed in the specification are appropriate. There's SHA-2 with flavors, SHA-256, 384, whatever.
SHA-3,
yeah, they're all appropriate replacements for the particular use of verifying certificates.
So, Clem, this is Steve. I think the question on the table still is, what is the usage of that particular regulation? In other words, so what application does the regulation apply? Does it apply to certificate validation, or does it apply to something else? Felipe?
Hi, good morning. I just wanted to point out to the committee that NIST does have this FIPS 180-4 out for public comment due by September 9th. And it appears they are requesting comment on disallowing SHA-1. So we could potentially just note that this is out for public comment and SHA-1 is under consideration to be disallowed.
Yeah, I think there is an announcement. If you go to the website, you can look at what exactly they want. And
that would make sense, so that if we're looking at a recommendation or a comment that says this particular standard is currently open for public comment, task force and high tech recommend that the situation be monitored and the standard updated as appropriate based on the final rule resulting from the comment period, or something of that ilk.
Yeah, that's right. Yes, you got it.
Okay, so I think we'll make notes and update the worksheet to reflect that. And then we'll revisit quickly next week as we review potential comments. Now shifting gears to public health, the first public health standard we're going to talk about is electronic laboratory reporting. And to help us understand and dig into public health reporting and ELR, we have a couple of speakers to help us understand what's going on, including Ricky and Rachel Abbey and company. So would you please introduce yourselves?
Sure, I'm Ricky Merrick. I'm the lead terminologist for the Association of Public Health Laboratories. I'm also the Orders and Observations co-chair and have been involved in ELR specification writing since the first one, the art one.
And Rachel, do you want to introduce yourself quickly? And then Ricky's got a wonderful little presentation to help bring us all up to speed.
Sure, absolutely. Thanks, Steve. My name is Rachel Abbey. I'm with ONC's Office of Policy, and I specifically work on issues related to public health and have been involved in this space and with Steve and Ricky for many years. So thank you.
And actually, Laura, do you want to introduce yourself, Laura Kahn?
Sure. Good morning. My name is Laura Kahn. I'm the electronic case reporting program lead at the CDC and just here to support the conversation between ELR and ECR if there's questions that arise.
Thank you so much for that. If I missed anybody, please introduce yourself. Okay, Ricky, do you want to go ahead and do your presentation, please?
Sure. Can you pull up my slides for me, please? Okay, so next slide. I was asked to talk a little bit about lab standards. This first one, I don't know much about. So I just provided links that I got from the food safety program at APHL. So just, I don't know what to say to these. So it's just background. Next slide. So this is more of what I can talk about. So ELR stands for electronic lab reporting, and it's reporting results of lab tests for reportable conditions to public health at any level, local, state, local and state mostly. So initially there was no national standard established, but various states had ELR implementation guides in 2.3 and 2.3.1 and some in 2.2 maybe. And some of these are still in use. But in 2009, we used several of those state-specific 2.3.1 guides and created the first national electronic laboratory reporting guide using version 2.2.5.1. And that's referred to as ELRR1. It's named in promoting interoperability regulation. And it's widely implemented in use in labs and at least all the state public health agencies, but probably also quite a few of the local public health agencies. And because it's so widely implemented, we worked on creating some adaptations to it to support HHS supporting elements for SARS-CoV-2 during the pandemic. When the ELRIG was named in for promoting interoperability regulation, NIST created a tooling to help with the certification of electronic health records. While we were building those toolings, we had to create a clarification document because some of the rules were, the table was saying one thing and the notes were saying another thing. So really, when you're implementing ELRR1, you should implement both the IG and the clarification document, because that really helps. And I have over here on the right the supported workflows of lab to public health. So next slide. So then we went on to look at, you know, the laboratory creates results, not with a main focus to report to public health, but really with a main focus to report to their clinician. And so in 2012 is probably when we started on this, with the SNI framework, we were trying to make it easier for the labs to create the standard that could do double duty, basically report the results to the provider and support CLIA, as well as reporting results to public health. So we created this lab reporting interface or LRI guide that has multiple profile components. So depending on which use case you're supporting, you can take the base LRI profile and then add on additional data elements. And so for the reporting to public health, that's the public health component that you add on the base LRI component. And that took all the ELRR1 data elements. So it initially was published as ELR release 2 as a separate standing document, because people were used to having an ELRIG guide, but it made it more confusing because we had two separate documents, but they were both using, you know, LRI as a component. So going forward in 2015 and then again in 2018, we published only LRI, but the public health component within that still represents the latest version of the original ELR. So I'm not sure if that, you know, how easy that is to understand. But what's important about LRI is that LRI in the base supports the CLIA elements. So everything the laboratory needs to report under CLIA to the ordering providers. It also has support for AOEs, and sometimes public health uses AOEs to get some of the public health information across to the labs, to public health, because that's currently the main way of public health automatically getting clinical information, for example, like pregnancy status or other things that public health might be needing. And the other thing that's interesting is that first LRI R2 has a functional requirements document for each RS certification. So when HL7 puts out an implementation guide, that is really just the specification of how the data goes across the wire. It does not necessarily talk about what the receiver must do with the data. But for a certification process, of course, that's an important piece. And so HL7 workgroup did work through and created this ERH functional requirements that says, if you are an EHR and you're getting an LRI R2, this is what you're going to have to do with each of these data elements, which is important for certification. That document has not been updated to the later versions because LRI was not included in promoting interoperability regulation. So next slide. And so this year, it should say 22, I'm sorry, must be a year behind. So this year in August, we are going to publish a new LRI, which includes the HHS requirements. And it also supports all the other use cases. So for example, one of the use cases in the earlier LRI R3 is newborn screening, which uses orders and results reporting to the provider. And so those use cases are still supported by this LRI guide. But it does relax some of the OID requirements for the public health component profile. So in the initial ELR R1, you needed to identify your assigning authorities. So those systems that create identifiers, like the patient identifier, the specimen identifier, the order identifier, they had to be identified using an OID, which is an object identifier. And we don't have a national OID registry. So for some of your partners, it will be really hard to use an OID to identify them as the assigning authority for identifiers. And most public health agencies had already relaxed that rule. So basically they were, you know, not really compliant to the ELR R1, but it's something that you have to do to make it work. And so this new version will support that and allow, for example, the use of CLIA or NPI as a means to identify the assigning authority. So in general, I would say ELR R1 is widely implemented for public health reporting and no changes would have to be made. However, from a broader perspective of supporting standards implementation in the laboratory space, moving to this latest version of LRI would probably be beneficial, because it actually describes what is current practice for public health agencies, like not requiring OIDs, but also allowing CLIA and NPI. It supports the HHS required elements for SARS-CoV-2 reporting. It has guidance around AUEs, and it includes all the CLIA elements so that when the lab implements the LRI base component, it can use that to also report to providers. So new implementations certainly should be considered, especially. But we should find out from the public health agencies how easy that is to support. And then for existing implementations, just for the public health reporting side, be interesting to figure out what the ROI is. I think that's it.
Thank you so much for that. Rachel, do you have anything to add?
No, thanks, Steve. Thanks, Ricky.
And Laura, do you have anything as initial observations? And can you talk for a moment about the intersection of ELR and ECR?
So nothing more to add on the ELR standards. I just want to, clarify for folks that both electronic lab reporting and lab reporting and case reporting are required by law in all U.S. states and territories. The electronic component varies across jurisdictions. Some actually have laws that say it needs to be submitted electronic, some do not. Both of these programs are working towards making electronic feeds to support those regulations in states. So they are complementary data feeds to public health agencies. ELR obviously focused on lab reporting, electronic case reporting focused on the provider mandated reporting. There is some laboratory information in an electronic case report, but not to the degree and detail that comes in an electronic lab report. At a public health agency, jurisdictions marry the two reports to get a full picture of a clinical person with a condition of interest to public health from the clinical perspective and from the laboratory results perspective. I think there have been discussions at times, especially during COVID, where the use of ask on order entry questions was, this might be strong, but seeking to force some clinical information into a lab result report that could potentially be found in an electronic case report. And electronic case reporting was just getting off the ground as COVID response was also ramping up. And so it's definitely not in place nationwide, but I think looking towards the future, we really want to be parsimonious around what data should be shared in what type of documents, either through or reports and through a lab report, if it's laboratory associated information or information that a laboratory needs in order to run that test. But if it's really clearly clinical data, those should be looked to as being shared through an electronic case report.
Yeah, just if you're looking at this image still, you know, I have the two arrows from the lab to public health and to the provider. And what Laura's talking about, the case report would go from the provider, the EHRS, over to public health. So it's an additional arrow.
And this is Steve, to add on to the discussion a little bit. There are really three channels of information exchange related to laboratory services and public health. One for electronic lab reporting, which is sending information about notifiable or reportable conditions to public health from a laboratory perspective. Second, looking at the electronic case report. And thirdly, laboratory services that may be provided by the public health lab. For example, the Department of State Health Services Public Health Lab or the Texas Department of State Health Services Public Health Lab does newborn screening testing and does use the LRI message to exchange data with submitting providers for a significant percentage of the 800,000-ish lab tests we perform on an annual basis. So there is that differentiation. Ricky, can you distinguish a little bit? I'm taking a co-chair's prerogative for a moment, that the difference between R1, what's in place right now, and what's being balloted or prepared for August 22 is an extension, but pretty much everything that is in R1, with the exception of the OID modifiers, are supported in the LRI with the pH components?
Yeah, so LRI as the base makes you choose whether you're identifying your assigning authorities using OIDs or if you allow other means. So the base LRI makes you make that choice. And the ELR originally was constrained to only use the OIDs. And so we have the only thing we've done in this release is we're relaxing the requirement that the public health component has of using OIDs. You can still use OIDs, but if you don't have an OID, you can also use a CLIA or an NPI to identify your assigning authority. But yes, there is no change in terms of the data elements that are in supported in ELRR1 versus the public health component in LRIR5.
Okay, wonderful. Clem, you had your hand up a moment ago. Do you still have a question? Are there questions or observations from the task force? Is there any clear realignment with HL7?
I'm not sure I understood that question, sorry.
is there a comment or question from chat? Oh. Looking at whether there's a, was there any need to do further modifications to messaging to support any of the CLIA changes that may be in the works?
Well, I don't know of any new CLIA. I mean, if there are new CLIA requirements, that weren't around when we initially worked on LRI, then we haven't been made aware of those. But the idea behind LRI was that we wanted to ensure that it supports all the CLIA elements. So one of the carrots to getting labs to implement LRI was to say, if you're implementing LRI, then you know some of your CLIA requirements around recertifying interfaces whenever there is a change made after the initial instantiation or implementation of an interface currently has to go through pretty rigorous retesting and re-verifying of the view that the provider has of the report, and it needs to get compared to the view that the laboratorian had when they made the report. And that takes a lot of time and resources. And so one of the carrots was LRI supports all those elements. And so once that's verified that you're actually doing LRI correctly and supporting all those CLIA elements, then some of those changes that invariably happen over time to an interface don't have to be that rigorously verified every single time.
Okay, thank you for that. So as we look at the worksheet for task force members, lines 23 and lines 24 are the core ELR reporting measure or reporting content, and then the supplementary material that Ricky mentioned. Do we want to make a recommendation that ONC consider moving to the 2022 release, but work on a plan that involving public health authorities and entities and stakeholders to ensure that there are appropriate resources available for any necessary transition? Is the task force comfortable with that type of recommendation, or is there another approach that would be preferable?
Stephen, that sounds reasonable to me. This is Devin.
Thank you
as well. This is Phil.
Thank you for that. Okay, we're now going to shift to, it has Craig been able to join us yet, Mike?
This is Craig Newman. I am here, yes.
Okay, Craig, great, wonderful. So we're now going to shift over to a discussion of immunization reporting. And Craig, can you talk a little bit about immunization registry reporting?
Sure. So Immunization registry reporting has been happening electronically for a good number of years. Historically, it has been using standards developed and published jointly by the American Immunization Registry Association, ERA, and the CDC. And so what you've got on your screen there is the most recent version, which is release 1.5. Again, that's this ERA.
Yep. I'm going to have to just long enough to please introduce yourself.
Oh, I'm sorry. I'll actually put some light on as well. My name is Craig Newman. I work with Altarum, and I am a member, I'm a co-chair of the HL7 Public Health Work Group. I've previously worked as a contractor with the CDC in the area of immunization standards. And so I have a history of contributing to writing and implementing some of these V2 implementation guides, including those related to immunization.
Thanks so much. Please continue.
Okay, sorry about that.
Oh, it's great. No, don't be sorry. I want to make sure that you're well recognized, because you've got great information and a great history and great insights.
Okay, great. Thank you. So release 1.5 was the most recent release of CDC ERA document. It was published in November of 2014. And then what you actually see here is shortly after that, about 7 months after that, an additional addendum was published. I contributed to the original 1.5 guide as a commenter, but ultimately, as that contractor to the CDC, I wrote the addendum. And so I'm familiar with that. And that really just did some clarification because we knew going into EHR certification for 2015 that there were some holes in the implementation guide. There always are. So we tried to clarify as best we could with the addendum. We also, I was also involved in creating the test cases for the 2015 EHR certification process. And so those reflected what's in the release 1.5 guide. As we were doing that work and afterwards, we sort of read between the lines or heard whispers. There was never anything official, but our understanding was that when new versions of certification came out, that it would be preferred if they pointed to an SDO balloted document. So while the ERA CDC documents were always available for public comment and input, they weren't officially balloted through HL7. So part of the work that we did was to create this version 2.8.2 implementation guide, which is an official HL7 balloted document. And the idea there was to have that official process behind it. It largely was based off of release 1.5, but it did make some relatively significant changes. Just the practical matter of things is that the community has settled on release 1.5, and ERA, together with CDC, has done a tremendous job helping remove some of the variation in the implementation of release 1.5 between jurisdictions. But that version 2.8.2 implementation guide never really got any practical traction in the community. And to my knowledge, has not been implemented by anyone at this point. That's sort of the background. I don't know, Steve, if there's anything else you want I can provide before we have whatever discussion you're planning on.
That was great background. I think kind of looking with to the future a little bit and talking a little bit about the Helios work and what might be coming next and how that impacts standards might be worth mentioning.
Sure. So the immunization community has been looking at FHIR for a few years. I can't speak officially for anybody, but my personal impression is that it took some time to educate the community on FHIR. I think There's excitement about what it can do. I think the Helios fire accelerator is new. It started up just towards the end of last year. We're about 7 or 8 months into that. One of the goals of the fire accelerator is not to rip and replace what's happening. So the goal, at least in the short and middle term, is not to replace the V2 messaging that is happening today that's well established, that is successful, and replace it with fire, but to augment in the immunization community with fire to do things that release 1.5 just isn't equipped to do, was never designed to do. That could be, we've already seen work in immunization, getting the COVID immunization status into the hands of consumers. Things we've talked about are about clinical decision support for forecasting and inventory management. And so I would say that the goals of the community are not to replace V2 messaging with fire, at least at this point. And I would say that Helios is behind that. There is a Helios priority area related to accessing immunization data in bulk from IIS so that authorized users like providers can access data on a population level to provide clinical care and better population support, but it is not expected to be a replacement for the V2 messaging that is implemented and has been successful.
Thank you for that. And I think also, again, as Craig mentioned, there's significant interest in fire and immunization community and some work going on, as Craig mentioned, looking at bulk fire, as well as some more limited work going on looking at individual messaging and individual data access. But there is not yet, to our knowledge, an implementation guide in development that is working on those specific aspects. So there's not like a 3. Or a version 2.9 or a version 3.1 waiting in the wings for near-term adoption.
Yeah, I would say in terms of V2 messaging, ERA and CDC are working on projects that are looking at gaps between release 1.5 and the real world. To try and clarify, there's been, beyond the addendum, there's been a number of guidance documents that have been published. And so they are working to make sure that the standards represent what's happening out there in the world. But they're, to my knowledge, and again, I can't speak for them, but to my knowledge, they're not planning on coming out with a whole new implementation guide, but they're still very much in the planning process, as I understand it.
Okay, wonderful. We have a few questions. Basil, would you like to ask your question? Is your hand raised?
Yeah, it was partially answered by the last comment that the additional guidance documents to clarify, for ongoing clarification, is it possible to add them to an updated regulation? Because if there's a lot of work from what I understand that happened since July 2015, until today, and it would be great if we can incorporate, if we keep that standard, to incorporate those additional guidance documents as well.
Yeah, and that's my understanding, is that they're looking at producing sort of a composite document. But again, I don't have all the details on that, but I believe that that's what they're hoping to do long term. Well, sort of short to medium term, but yeah.
Thank you. Basil, that was an excellent point. Do we have other questions from the task force? Or any other observations or a recommendation as to a path forward?
I will mention one last thing, that version 2.8.2, as with any HL7 standard for trial use, it has a limited lifetime. I forget off the top of my head when the current STU expires. It can always be extended if we want to go that route, but I don't know that the CDC sponsors of that have intent to extend that. So again, you might would need to talk with them in the IISSB Immunization Information System Support Branch at CDC to know what their expectations are, but that version 282 may be retired if it's not actively extended. Again, it will still be available to people, but it won't be an active standard.
But I would concur with your observation that there's certainly been focus on the 1.5 standard, and like yourself, I am not aware of any in the field implementation of 282. The 1.5 is currently supported in the promoting interoperability program requirements so that Medicare providers that were not complying with the 1.5 IG might run into some issues looking at seeking Medicare payments and might be impacted negatively on reimbursement rates if they weren't complying with the 1.5 guide, assuming that the public health authority was also using the 1.5. So it may make sense to look at a recommendation that says maintain the 1.5 IG, but look to the compiled addendum or replacing it or updating it as the evolution continues and as the guidance documents might be incorporated into a more updated or a more current version, but not yet necessarily a 2.0 version, something like a 1.7 or 1.8 or whatever the numbering works out to be.
Yeah, my personal opinion is that's a very realistic and reasonable approach.
Is that a recommendation that we should draft for continual review or for review and potential forwarding to HITACH?
That seems reasonable to me.
Yeah, I agree.
Okay, we'll make notes in the worksheet and send those out for review.
And sir, if I may make a suggestion, there is a draft of that, if it could be shared with the folks at ERA for their feedback, just to make sure it aligns with their understanding, I think that would be a good thing to do. And I'm happy to also comment if that's at all helpful, but I think getting ERA's input, it will be critical.
Thank you very much for that. Yes, there is a comment period or comment review process for task force recommendations, for HITACH recommendations to ONC.
Excellent, thank you.
So we will now shift to syndromic surveillance. Which is line, I'm looking for, there we go, sorry, line 22 in the worksheet. And I believe we've got some folks. Rosa, were you here to talk about syndromic?
I'm here to participate in the discussion, but I don't have anything to present.
Okay. Well, as a resource. So looking at syndromic surveillance has been included as a public health reporting measure for some time as part of the promoting interoperability program requirements. In the current iteration of proposed final rules and expected future final rules, syndromic surveillance reporting is required by hospitals participating in the Medicare promoting interoperability program if they do not submit data and the public health authority has the capability to receive the data. It may impact hospitals' ability to receive maximum Medicare reimbursements. The current standard in regulation is release 2.0, which was released in 2015. There is a updated version of Syndromic Surveillance Release 1 US Realm from 2019. Rosa, can you give share any information you'd like to share about Syndromic?
No.
Okay. Are there any questions or observations from the task force regarding what we should do with syndromic surveillance standards?
Steve, is there a documentation of what the updates are that are included in the 2019 version?
I do not have them as a short list. I believe that some of the modifications included additional support for patient identifiers, among other things. Do we need to revisit this when we have more information and a tighter comparison between the different versions?
I personally would love to see that. It's not something that I am aware of. I have not been engaged in this discussion for very long.
Okay, wonderful. Let's move to line 25, which is cancer registries. The current regulatory framework includes HL7 implementation guide, release 2, and release 1, dated from 2015 as a draft standard for trial use. There has not been a lot of work done in updating the HL7 standard for cancer reporting to public health. Some public health agencies all public health agencies support the HL7 standard to be consistent with federal regulations and promoting interoperability programs. Many public health agencies also support a different standard simultaneously for exchange produced by NACER, the National Association of Cancer Registries, and support information submission using that standard as well. We do not have information at hand about what percentage of data is being received by public health using the different standards. It might be a good suggestion to suggest maintaining that standard, but at the same time, doing an evaluation of standard utility to understand how much that standard is actually being used in the field and potentially make an adjustment at the next cycle. I'd like to open the floor for comments or suggestions in that space. Is that a recommendation that we want to make?
That seems like a good approach to me, Stephen.
Okay, yeah. If there's someone who's got additional insight on cancer reporting, it would be wonderful if there's an interest in sharing. So I'll draft some text and include that in the worksheet as a potential recommendation for the task force to consider it and push forward. The next standard is line 26, or sorry, yeah, line 26, HL7 implementation guide for CDA release 2, level 3 for healthcare associated infection reports. And there is a new release inserted in SFAP, which was made of it, or which is coming to be available at the end of August. Is there a suggested approach or suggested recommendation of the task force? Is this another instance where we recommend that ONC consider utilizing the data or the standards in the SFAP and continue that support and looking at moving in that direction?
Is that, Stephen, is that relevant to Hans's comment in the document, misalignment? I wasn't sure what he meant by NHSN. He's calling, he says there's misalignment. Is that what you're referring to?
Yeah, one of the challenges is we're looking as the at the SFAP progression is looking at dependencies, and there's the potential to get a standard in place, like a new version of CDA. If we haven't adopted the new version of the CDA, then it is difficult to utilize a standard that's dependent upon that CDA or USCDI for operationalizing that standard. So how do we approach it to ensure that there's alignment between a standard that we would like and any standard required to support that implementation? Because we've run into that several places.
So the proposal here would be to leave, to maintain the standard as is, but also support the SFAP?
Well, to make the recommendation to ONC that there is a standard included in SFAP so that the SFAP, you know, healthcare vendors can utilize the SFAP listed tools for early implementation, but looking at monitoring its utilization for future adoption as the formal standard. And how do we get, how does that sequence occur? At what time period so that you look at an orderly transition? And that's kind of an ongoing challenge, that it's being released or available at the end of next month. At what period, how long does a standard have to be published for to be considered for adoption or utilization? You know, do we want to make a recommendation that there should be a time period involved in looking at something, you know, being listed in SFAP before it be considered for modification of the standard as the full utilization, or do we leave it alone? And that, the same issue would apply in several different places.
Yeah, I suspect, Stephen, that that's going to depend on the context, right? There may be situations where there's insufficient sort of voluntary uptake of the newest standard under SFAP. And so there's a need to retire the old one to push people to get to the latter one. And but in another context, it may be premature. And I'm not sure there's sort of a standard, a time standard that would necessarily apply across all the contexts. And it's something that ONC is the ultimate sort of rulemaker here is going to need to consider. I think the best that we can do is in the context of a particular standard to provide a recommendation when there is a need to sort of retire a standard. I think that's partly our job, is to provide that recommendation, but where there isn't sort of clear evidence about retiring or maintaining, I'm not sure it makes sense for us to say, you know, it takes X amount of time for a standard on SVAP to sort of reach the level where it should be elevated. Because
maybe we can either stay silent or maybe make a more generalized statement that says, consider adoption rates or whatever is moving something from SVAP into the formally adopted standard without attaching a number, time period, et cetera, but just as a yardstick to be considered, whether it's a yardstick or a furlong measure or whatever, that may be something that ONC needs to decide that maybe, again, measure specific. Okay, wonderful. Moving on to line 27, looking at national health care surveys. The draft standard for trial use is what's currently in regulation. It was adopted in 2014. There is a new iteration in SVAP, looking at release 3. It's the same type of issue, looking at replacement rates and how to cycle through. So do we treat it the same? And the National Health Care Survey data is reported directly to CDC as the consumer of that data. So do we want to make the same type of recommendation?
Yeah, it appears Hans is saying his opinion is that we leave the newest version as SVAP and maintain, from how I'm reading that.
Yeah. Looking at line 28, standard code set CVX, vaccines administered, updates through August 17, 2015. What this code set is a subset of CVX codes that are used for certification purposes. It is not the entire library of CVX codes. There's not a more currently published version. As long as the CVX file layout is consistent, again, it's a subset that they're using for testing purposes. So do we have a recommendation in that space? Is this something we should leave? Do we need to get additional data or additional information from a testing end? Ron, from a testing certification end of it, is there without looking specifically at this particular code set, can you offer some guidance or suggestions as to whether there may be utility in updating a code set with a more modern data set, even if the file layout is the same and you're really testing about file layout more than the content? Can someone offer some insights in that space? Craig.
Testing point of view, the older value set is probably sufficient. The expectation has always been set with implementers that the most recent set of CVX codes as published by the CDC should be supported. That's one of the changes we made in the 282 guide, actually, is to specifically label the CVX value set as being dynamic. You're correct, it's not the full CVX, but as critical new CVX codes, such as for the COVID vaccines, have been added, the expectation is that they be utilized. I don't know how that impacts your approach to testing, whether it's important to be able to test the most recent codes. From a practical point of view, you know, as long as a CVX code can be used to populate a V2 message, it's typically not quite so important as to what that code is. So from a testing perspective, it's probably sufficient. From a real world utility point of view, it'll be very important that newer codes are populated.
Right.
I don't know if that helps or not.
I very much appreciate that. And the task force's position is really looking at maintaining, at suggesting a particular standard be maintained or retired. Again, if there's not a more current code set, the limitation, if you will, of the code set listed is it's just a subset of codes that was established in 2015. And that's just the descriptor. And again, from a testing perspective that's outside the task force's purview, is there a need for having more current codes available for use in testing? And is that something that, even if the task force can't determine that, is that something that we should recommend or acknowledge or note in a recommendation about maintaining? Just looking at a description of that code set that says something along the lines of, this code set represents CVX codes that were available through 2015 and may not include more current vaccines. So that if testing scenarios are intended to be more specific or utilize more recent vaccines, you may need to modernize. Is that a recommendation that the task force cares to make? Or do we just say maintain as is? Or do we say retire?
Yeah, Stephen, it seems we may want to include, so I'm trying to understand, is this just an arbitrary date, this August 17th, 2015, or is there a newer date that we could recommend?
There is no more current code set published. So this is the standard, if you will, at its last published date.
My recollection from that process is, in order to be able to point the testing tools to a defined list of CVX, a subset of CVX codes, there had to be an official publication, however you want to think of it. And so that was the origin of this list. It was mostly just a technical requirement, as I recall.
Yeah.
But the code still on it should certainly still be viable and appropriate for use. There just might not be, it might be incomplete relative to what's expected to be exchanged in the field.
Right. There may be vaccines. Well, there are certainly vaccines that are available today that are not in the code set because they're newer vaccines. Same thing can also be true, is that there are vaccines in the code set that have been retired subsequent to 2015. So it's not, that list is not used for clinical care. It's used strictly for testing purposes. So I think the question for the task force is, I think, you know, in a recommendation, probably a list, some list needs to be maintained or made available. So I think the question really is, hey, recommendation to maintain and potentially modernize if you need to test against vaccines that were released after August 17th, 2015.
That makes sense to me.
And just call, you know, kind of calling attention to that limitation of the code set. So we can make that happen. Looking at line 29, public health data systems, consortium source of payment topology code set version 5.0, October 2011, there is a new version. Version 9.2 is available. What this list is a catalog of different payment types. And version 9.2 expands on categories that were established in version 5.0. I've not done a line by line comparison. I am unsure where this topology is used specifically. Do we make a recommendation that it be replaced or that further research may be needed to ensure that the new code set is inclusive of previous codes so that a migration to a new code set adds flexibility but does not require a recode or a reanalysis because codes are lost? Do we have a recommendation? Most of the comments in the existing worksheet are phase out, replace, or update. So if there's no concern with that as a recommendation, we'll draft some text for the task force to review that elaborates on that idea, again, calling attention to ensuring that, you know, based upon the concept that the new code set does not eliminate codes that were established in the previous version, it's backwards compatible, that an update should be advanced or should be considered. Looking at line 30, National Drug Code Directory Vaccine NDC Linker updates through August 17th, 2015. The current worksheet has comments that range from working maintain to retire. Do we need to get additional information and revisit it? I am not aware of a replacement code set. Again, I believe that this code set is used primarily for testing purposes. And not as a live data set for clinical care. Is the task force interested in getting additional information and revisiting it next week? Would that be helpful? I think we'll revisit it. Mike, do we want to go to public comment?
Sure, we can do that. Put up the public comment slide. We're going to open up our call for public comments. If you're on Zoom and would like to make a comment, please use the hand raise function, which is located on the Zoom toolbar at the bottom of your screen. If you happen to be on the phone only, press *9 to raise your hand, and once called upon, press *6 to mute or unmute your line. So let's pause to see if anyone raises their hand. Not seeing any hands raised, Steve, so I'll turn it back to you, but we'll continue to monitor.
Okay, thank you. I'd like to open the floor for any comments or questions from our task force members today, looking at the standards we've reviewed or upcoming questions regarding standards for next meeting, which we will be looking at additional standards. We're making good progress, but we do need to report out on our progress to HITECH at the upcoming HITECH meeting in mid-August. But I think we're making good progress. Again, if there are any comments from task force members, we'd love to hear from you. Or is this process working for you? Is there additional information that needs to be provided to better evaluate standards? Are there changes in process that we can use to make it more effective? Do you have the information that you need?
I can't think of any at this point, Stephen.
Okay. Yeah, me neither, Stephen. Sorry for the silence. I'm like, I think you and Hans are doing an amazing job at taking us through all these items. And, you know, it's not always easy when, you know, you have expertise in some and not in others to keep up. I do wish we were getting a little bit more public comment, but we can't make people come to these meetings. So I think we're doing the best with what we've got. And having the speakers today, I thought was really helpful.
John.
Add a little bit more information. Thank you.
John, please raise.
Yes, thank you. This is John Kilbourn. Yes, I share that. Thank you very much for holding this together despite our silences. And for these cases like the NDC codes and the CVX codes, like, what are we supposed to do? Like, I don't, like, I guess I had a naive idea that SFAP would make it all better. But if the organization that makes the standard doesn't update the standard, it's like we're stuck. Anyway, I guess I'm just voicing my complaint. I don't have a suggestion. I'm just like, I don't see an obvious thing to do in cases like that with the CVX, for instance, where if CDC doesn't update their CVX list, what can anybody do? Anyway,
looking at that's an excellent question. Looking at that particular code set, it's actually what that standard was established to do, which makes a difference. It's not that CDC has not updated the CVX code set. It's that that particular standard is used exclusively for testing EHR technology. And there hasn't been a request made by ONC to update the list of CVX codes, or if there has been, the responsible entity has not yet updated that code set. So my expectation personally is that yes, you need, if you're testing something related to CVX codes and EHRs, you need a set of CVX codes to test against. Without understanding or knowing testing methodology and what is actually being tested for, it may be that you could use a CVX code from 1976, if CVH codes existed at 76, and it would be perfectly valid for that testing purpose. For example, if you were just populating a particular field with a CVX code. But if you're looking at decision-based or computer decision support testing that's reliant on a particular vaccine being applied or being administered, and that vaccine is not in the code set, then you can't test the AHR functionality around that particular code. So in the narrow sense of having a CVX code to test against, the existing standard might be sufficient for that purpose. But if you're looking at changing testing criterion for other purposes, you might need to modernize that particular standard. Does that make sense?
Yes, very much. Thank you for clarifying that. So the standard that we're looking at is not the actual list of CVX codes that are the actual list, but this sort of derived or, you know, put in, you know, not pretend, but selected list for testing, which will tell you that you have the right numeric fields and your right, you know, your API call will not crash, but it won't actually help you with the current content of the vaccines because it doesn't have current, you know, vaccines any, you know, more current than whatever that was, 2017 or whatever the year was. Anyway, thank you. I do understand that I was misunderstanding that we're talking about the actual CVX code list itself, and that's not what we were
talking about. So for this particular standard, do we make the recommendation maintain but observe that, hey, the standard has not been updated since 2017. If you're looking at testing functionality based on what the actual vaccine is,
that won't work.
You may be out of date. If you're only testing for a CVX code, then you may be fine. But note that some CVX codes may have been retired since that date.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. And who owns that? Then who's responsible for updating that document or that artifact or that standard? Like, that's, and I'm sorry if I'm just asking a really dumb question. Like,
no, that particular standard is maintained by NAHDO.
So it's not, it's not the actual official CVX list maintained, well, I think by CDC. Okay. Okay. Then, yeah. And maybe just adding that disclaimer or that, you know, added comment, maybe that would be helpful for now. Cause I don't know how much influence there is to like actually get the standard changed. It might be another 10 years, you know, well, it might be another period of time before the standard actually gets changed.
Well, in this particular case, it would be ultimately up to ONC or HHS as to whether there is a necessary change in testing protocol that would benefit from a different list of CVX info, right?
Yes.
If they're not changing the testing methodology, and the methodology is only, hey, can you populate a message with a CVX code and send it on?
Then we're good. Yeah.
Then there's no need to change.
Yeah.
But if you're looking at, you know, things like error checking, hey, is it a valid CVX code?
Yes. Then that
If you're checking one of these subsets against the real CVX code, and the CVX code was retired in the real world, then you're going to pop an error.
And maybe testing for validity isn't really a useful kind of test for this content that changes like drugs and it changes so frequently. So you could test for a valid, some other kind of code, you know, I was going to say gender code, but that's kind of changing a lot too now, but just, you know, how many volts are in your power line, that probably isn't going to change.
Right.
Like, but for content that changes with some velocity, maybe is that worth saying that that's a different kind of test and needs to be treated differently?
We don't know what the testing protocol is. So from a task force recommendation, if we said something on the lines, hey, be cognizant of the limitations of the code set and how it may impact your testing. That if you're testing against more current codes, you may have an issue. But if all your testing is populating with a CVX code, there's no need to change, right?
I like that. I like what you're saying. I mean, that makes a lot of sense to me personally.
Here we got a question in chat. Where does RxNorm, for example, hold the CVX NDC vaccine crossworks? Never mind, disregard my question. So we can certainly include text like that in a recommendation, and we can put something together for the task force to review. Happy to do so. Are there any other questions or observations before we close our meeting?
Just an observation from my side, Stephen, is it looks like, so when I click on this link on line 30, it does, I can't find a reference to that August 17th, 2015 date. So I'm wondering if that is, if that was a date chosen when this standard was originally adopted, or if that's something where we could go in there and update that and say updates through this updated date, which would incorporate some of the newer codes.
Sure. We can look at updating that information, making sure it's current and complete. Well, I would like to thank our speakers and our guests for joining us on this meeting. I'd like to thank the task force members for their input. I would also like to thank the ONC and other staff for supporting us. And I would most certainly like to thank our guests and viewers for observing and participating in this work group meeting or this task force meeting. Our next meeting is scheduled for next Tuesday at 10:30 Eastern Time, again virtually, and ONC will send you a link for the meeting. In the meanwhile, if there are any questions, please feel free to contact us by email. I will turn the floor over to Mike to close us out and take care of any remaining business. Mike?
Oh, thank you, Steve, for holding down the fort while Hans is out. I know it's a lot to manage the entire meeting by yourself. So thank you so much. And we'll look forward to seeing everyone next week. So meeting is adjourned.